From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Marlee Dias talks about what inspired her to create the 1,000 Black Girl Books campaign and what still drives her work.
I think it's really important that we value diversity and the way that it helps other people be empathetic and respect others' experiences. So I want to make sure that every student can now have the experience of being able to see themselves as the main character and see their classmates reflected as the main characters in the books that they're assigned.
Later, the challenges of attracting young people to taking up a life on the farm.
I feel like it might be hard to ask a young person like myself who had a 9-to-5, who had a 401k, benefits, weekends off, to exchange that for a life of farming.
And we'll learn about one of the most influential composers you might never have heard of, Henriette Renier. Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. About 3 years ago, now 14-year-old Marlee Dias decided to collect and donate 1,000 children's books that feature Black girls as the lead character. It turned into a viral social media campaign with a hashtag, 1,000 Black Girl Books.
Since then, she's written her own book, Marlee Gets It Done and So Can You, served as an editor-in-residence of her own digital zine on Elle.com, and has spoken at national events on girls and women. To date, her campaign has resulted in more than 12,000 books collected.
Marlee will be the keynote speaker at the inaugural State of Wisconsin Girls Summit at Alverno College this weekend, which will address issues facing girls in Wisconsin from cyberbullying to poverty. Lake Effect's Mayon Silver spoke with Marlee about what prompted her to start the 1,000 Black Girl Books.
I started 1,000 Black Girl Books because I was an avid reader. And in my fifth grade class, I was so excited that I was able to finally have, assigned readings, and I got to be a part of this reading community. But I noticed that all these books featured white boys and their dogs as the main character. So I became very frustrated because as much as I love to read, we were reading the same type of story over and over again, and we didn't get to learn about other people's experiences. Now, in my own home, my mom and my dad had always provided me with books that featured Black girls like me, white boys and their dogs, Latina girls, Asian boys, people of all different experiences. And I think it's really important that we value diversity and the way that it helps other people be empathetic and respect others' experiences. So I want to make sure that every student can now have the experience of being able to see themselves as the main character and see their classmates reflected as the main characters in the books that they're assigned.
What role has seeing that representation in books meant to you?
A huge importance of being able to recognize yourself. It boosts confidence. And it also allows for kids to become more engaged in literacy. So a lot of the times reading is used as a punishment where if you're on your phone, your parents might say, go to your room and read, or why don't you read a book? And they use this negative connotation and these negative words to associate with books. What we want to do by seeing yourself, you see, oh my God, I can relate to this. This is what my parents say. This is what my community is like. So now I want to read more stories where I can see myself and feel as though I'm valued. And with regards to identity, if we're able to see that, oh, I'm reading a book about a Black girl and I'm a Black girl and they had a really difficult situation where they had friendship drama or they didn't know what to do and they were stressed with school, we can look at these characters and relate to their experiences and their resources and their education and say, okay, now I have the tools to be able to change the world or, handle friendship drama and things like that.
Well, in talking about the tools to change the world, was it your plan to become an activist or was it just as simple as trying to highlight representation for young Black girls?
So I don't think even that I call myself an activist, but it's definitely been the title that has been given to the work that I do. And I love my title. I love the fact that I can do something that gives me a title. But when I started, it was really out of this frustration of not seeing myself reflected. And it wasn't to think, oh, I want to become an activist. I think that this is my career. This is what I want to do. But it was that I was so frustrated that my parents would always push me to just, even the little things, want to create change to not only better the system for yourself, but better those around you. So I don't think that I was like, it was a goal, like, oh, this is the word that can describe exactly how I want to create change. But if we normalize activism in a way where it's not even a title, but just a part of every person's life, I think that's the next step we can reach as people that want to create social change.
It just naturally evolved as something you were passionate about.
Yes, that's exactly how it evolved.
So what are some of the books that you've discovered in this campaign that you would like people to know about? And, like, can you give us a little synopsis of something?
So I'll go from youngest to, like, oldest. So one of the books for around, you know, second grade, fourth grade is One Crazy Summer by Rita Williams Garcia. This is a great book. I definitely talks about the different sides of the civil rights movement. So we know a lot about, you know, charismatic leaders like, you know, Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and Coretta Scott King, but we don't learn a lot about the Black Panther Party. And what this book does is it talks about three young girls and their experience going to visit their mother in as she's a Black Panther. And they learn a lot about civil rights and how it's not just about Martin Luther King. And it talks a lot about sisterhood, which is really important to me, and creating these community spaces that help facilitate change and growth. So my fifth to seventh grade book, I would say, is Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson. Jacqueline Woodson is my favorite author of all time. She has been a huge supporter of 1,000 Black Girl Books, and Brown Girl Dreaming is her memoir, but it's written in verse. So it definitely teaches a lot of skills that educators can use about understanding poetry and deciphering poetry. But it is also really emotional, and it talks a lot about, you know, moving from urban spaces in New York and in more like urban and populated areas and going to rural spaces, and how you can translate and kind of a code switch as a Black girl in those communities. And then my last book, which is for teenagers and above, so I would say eighth grade and up, is Another Brooklyn, once again, by Jacqueline Woodson. I think that she tells these stories in, like, such beautiful ways about friendship. And with Another Brooklyn, it talks about gentrification of New York, which is something that happened a lot in the 1970s, but it also happened a lot now. So I think it's something that teachers can use as both a history lesson, but also as a tool to help create conversations, just like the summit wants to do, about how we can change the world and how we can help each other and be communities that want to create change.
So in the first book you mentioned, you talked about the connection between civil rights and sisterhood, that both of those are elements present in the book. Can you talk about the intersection of being Black and being a girl, or in some cases being a woman? What does that intersection mean to you?
I think this is a phenomenal question, because a lot of the time intersectionality is not a term that we like to bring up because they think it's too big for kids to understand. But intersectionality is so important to sharing our experiences, because I cannot just relate to the single experience of being Black or the single experience of being a girl. But in fact, there is a multitude of ways in which my experience has crossed paths, whether it's experiencing racism and sexism, whether it's being able to speak to millions of Black girls, because we can all relate about doing our hair at night and sleeping with a bonnet and having a sit between our parents' legs when they braid our hair. And it talks, I think intersectionality is what allows for me to relate to so many young people, because we are at these crossroads where all of us meet in some way, and we're able to use those experiences at that path to help create change and tell our stories.
How can social structures and for instance, schools support that intersection?
I think the best way that schools can support these intersections right now is by showing media that first explains intersectionality, and then showing videos in class and meeting people that are activists like me, or people like Yara Shahidi, or people like the people that run the Women's March, talking to people like Tarana Burke. And there are wonderful women out there that are creating change. And if we're able to talk to them and watch videos and learn about their ideas and their experiences, they talk about intersectionality in not only a way that is fun and engaging, but in a way that is serious and convincing. So I think we can do that by implementing into curriculums ways for media that help kids see activists.
And what were your expectations in starting this project and building a collection of books, which is it beyond 11,000 books now?
We're at 12,000 books right now. And it has exceeded my expectations so much. I didn't even think I was actually going to collect 1,000 Black Girl books. It was really about the process of just, you know, starting a goal, wanting to create a project, and then pursuing it as much as I possibly could. And through the power of social media and TV appearances and all these teachers and educators that support the campaign, we have now reached 12,000 books.
How far do you see this campaign going? Like, what future do you envision for the campaign?
So I started 1,000 Black Girl Books to fill the gap that I saw in fifth grade. And I still want to continue to collect and donate books to schools and communities. But I think that we are now expanding to the digital stage where we want to create this app that is the resource guide. So we have an online resource guide on our website. The website is www.grassrootscommunityfoundation.org. And that has a list of 1,000 of the books that have been collected. But we want to make sure that we can create apps so that independent authors or self-published authors are able to get their stories out there and can express the experiences of Black girls and show that to more educators and get it into the hands of more superintendents to create curriculums that surround diversity and inclusion.
Is it remotely possible for one person to read those 12,000 books? Are you taking a stab at it?
I have been taking a stab at the picture book. I've been working my way through every single picture book because they are so short compared to the books, because we have such a wide variety. You know, we have books that are pre-K books, and we also have books that are full academic journals. So we try to make sure that there's a variety, and I read the ones that are, you know, the most buzzworthy or the ones that I know people are reading right now so we can talk about them. But, you know, it's a lot of books, 12,000 books, so I'm trying my best.
Yeah, it would take, you know, years probably to get through all of that.
I'm a fast reader, and if I could get some of my friends on this, I think we could tackle a lot of them. But for now, we're just working page by page.
Has anything surprised you about some of the authors or some of the books that you've read that maybe you weren't expecting?
I think one of the things that surprised me about the authors was the fact that they are self-published. So I was wondering, why are there so many Black girl books that are not in schools? And it's because a lot of them are not published through big publishing houses. We have Simon & Schuster, we have Little Brown Books, we have Scholastic, and they're all publishing lots of books every year, and they're mega corporations. But a lot of the authors that are telling these stories of Black girls are self-published or from really small publishing houses. So their books are not put on the same national stage or even international stage as these big publishing houses' books that they create and they publish. So I was so surprised to see that there are so many books out there. It's just that we do not have access to them because they are not on the same platform as books that come from really big publishing houses.
Are you thinking of maybe creating a space where all of these books can exist in one space?
So that's what we want to use the resource guide for. I think that the best way to do it is digitally. In today's day and age, it's the best way to get all of these books out there in the best way we can, put them all on the same platform, same stage, same level of promotion, and make it really easy for people to buy and support these authors.
And we're going to shift a little bit now. You're going to be in town for the Wisconsin Girls Summit. What does it feel like to be the keynote speaker at just 14 years old?
I am so excited to be the keynote speaker at this inaugural Girls Summit in Wisconsin. I'm so happy because we don't have a lot of conferences that are focused on facilitating conversations with girls, by girls, and for girls. So I'm so excited that we were able to talk about the challenges and the issues that girls face, and then talk about the intersectionality of girls of color, LGBTQ girls, and girls with so many different experiences. And I think this conference is a great place to facilitate it, and I hope I can motivate other girls to want to be student activists and social activists.
Thank you so much, Marley Dias, and good luck.
Oh, thank you so much. Have a nice day.
You too.
Marley Dias is the creator of the 1,000 Black Girl Books campaign and author of the book Marley Gets It Done and So Can You. The 14-year-old will be the keynote speaker at the inaugural State of Wisconsin Girls Summit at Alverno College this weekend. She spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver, and you can read more about her and this weekend's event at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break, and then our seasoned farming contributor brings in a new farmer to talk about challenges and growth and how to attract more young people into the business. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Our farming contributor Dave Kozlowski owns and operates Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek with his wife Sandy Rodens. They gave up other careers more than a decade ago in order to pursue the demanding and rewarding profession of farming. Kozlowski says it was a steep learning curve, but their fellow farmers were a big help as they got started.
Now the mentee is becoming the mentor. For this month's farming segment, Kozlowski brought along Sarah Krohn of Village Farmstead, which is also in Oak Creek. She gave up her previous career just about a year ago to farm full-time, though she and her partner Sam Oden had almost 10 years of community gardening and hobby farming behind them. Oden's sister will join their team this year, as well as they grow organic produce for direct sales to consumers.
Krohn and Kozlowski joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio recently to discuss their different perspectives on farming, its challenges, and rewards. Krohn starts by explaining how she knew she had to become a farmer.
I didn't know anything about farming or business, but I kind of had this moment when I was in college and I didn't really know what I wanted to study, and I kind of had some resistance to joining the workforce and doing a 9-to-5, which I couldn't find anything that I wanted to do. And I studied environmental ethics, and I thought about all these scholars and authors that I was reading about and farmers, and I just thought that this was such a wholesome way to spend my life, just like growing things that we directly need every single day. And so we decided after some years of practice that we would take the plunge and go for it. But we didn't know anything about business, and we're learning that it's definitely a business if we're trying to make a livelihood out of it. But we just learned through experience and from mentors such as Dave and Sandy and other farmers that have welcomed us into the community.
Now, for both of you, you know, what was that learning curve like? And is there still one for you, Dave?
Thankfully, there is still one. I mean, when the job becomes boring and you're not learning something, I don't want to do it anymore. So, yeah, every year is a challenge. Every year we learn something. And, you know, I want to say I met Sam, Sarah's partner, before I met Sarah. I was so impressed with his questions and his interest in the business and farming that I was just thrilled that we had young farmers like this coming into the profession. But yeah, I'm still learning. And I would say our stories are fairly similar. I wanted to make the world a little better place, and we just jumped in with both feet into farming. And at that time, there were a number of small farms doing the same thing in the area. And we took advantage of their generosity and time by stopping and visiting them and learning what they were doing. So pretty much similar to what Sam and Sarah do. So to me, that's the best way to figure things out. Books help, but really it's just talking to another farmer. And that's what we did. And still do, by the way. We still stop at farms.
For you, Sarah, were you surprised at maybe the number of farms that were available for you and your partner, Sam, to go and learn from, like Dave and Sandy? Because, I mean, do we know the number comparative difference between how many farmers you could go and talk to versus you going into farming now in 2018, 19?
Yeah, I mean, we've lost some, but it probably doubled or tripled in that time. Mm-hmm. We had to drive out west of Madison to find a few farms to talk to.
When we first started, the first thing that we decided to do was let's talk to farmers in the area. Let's find farms that are doing things similar to what we aspire to do. And let's call them on the phone and see if they'll just talk to us. And we did. That's how we met Dave and Sandy. We called them on the phone and said, hey, we're thinking about starting a farm. Can we pick your brain? Do you have any wisdom to offer us? And every single farm that we called was more than willing to have a conversation with us, to invite us over. We've just been so welcomed into the farming community that it's a place that I want to stay. And I definitely hope that more people feel welcomed into it as well.
How do you think you can foster more growth? You know, people of the younger generation, as you mentioned, most go into the 9-to-5 job fields or, you know, the more conventional degrees to study, and they're not thinking per se about working the land. And a lot have lost that family connection to farms. You know, no one has a family farm owned by their grandparents or great-grandparents or have that connection to the land.
Yeah, I think we're in an interesting spot right now. I think a lot of young people are really interested in farming, and they are interested in changing the way that we eat, and they're changing the way that their lifestyles are. I feel like it might be hard to ask a young person like myself who had a 9-to-5, who had a 401k, benefits, weekends off, to exchange that for a life of farming. But I think a lot more people are interested in it, and we try to encourage our friends who want to come over to be put to work. Like, let's do some farming together. And at the end of the day, it's always so rewarding. They feel rewarded. They feel like they made a difference. They feel like the farm is partly theirs, too. And I just think that it's just a good community for people our age to start getting involved in. And I think they're interested in doing it, too.
Yeah, I think there's two tracks we have to sort of keep abreast of here. One is, like Sarah and ourselves and so many young farmers, you have to have the mindset and the philosophy to want to do this. And it doesn't matter whether you're growing organic produce or you want to do dairy cows or corn and soybean. I mean, farming is farming. And so you're going to want to do that kind of work. The other track, particularly as it pertains to us, is for those people who are sitting on the fence, we've got to convince them that you can actually make a living doing this. And there's not much ways we can cut our costs, so we have to hope that the public is interested in buying what we produce.
Right. We do need the people that support organic farming as well. Like, not everyone has to be a farmer, but we have to have the people that understand it and they're willing to maybe spend a little bit more money than they're going to spend at Costco buying something that's organic but doesn't have a face or a name that comes along with it.
Now, you mentioned, Sarah, you know, trading the salaries you may get, benefits, weekends off, vacations. You know, you guys are working probably more than you ever have. How has your relationship with money and risk changed as you've changed to the life of a farmer? How do you see things differently?
Well, risk is, it's always a thing that's in our minds. I happen to be a very frugal person in the first place, which made transitioning to farming relatively easy at this point. We're still very new to it, so I can't really speak for what this means financially for us. But I think that the risk of not having benefits or dental insurance, like, those things are okay for me to exchange for different things that I value, such as being my own boss, working with the sunlight hours, moving my body like it was intended to be moved, and just kind of going with those natural rhythms of the universe instead of these values that society holds up, like weekends and paid vacation. Like, those things are a valid exchange for me.
Farmers, I tend to find, are some of the smartest people I know. And along with that is being able to accommodate these kinds of risks and challenges and meet them head on and find solutions to them rather than crumble under the weight of them. And that seems to be a main tenet of pretty much any farmer if they're going to stay in the business. Managing money, what's money? we don't worry about that part, but the risk is a significant challenge, and you have to be willing to meet that challenge.
Dave, you mentioned that farmers are good problem solvers. I'm curious, what have you both found to be the hardest part about farming, whether there's one particular story, an instance of just a crop that gave you all the difficulties, or just the things that you've learned throughout to adjust to?
That's a tough one. There's a lot of things that are hard about farming. But at this point in the game for me, something that I have noticed is the hardest thing is meeting customer expectations. We live in a world of convenience and busyness, and people have lost their connection with food and they've lost their consciousness about food. And I'm finding that it's hard to take your whole life and turn it upside down to grow this produce so that someone can have a beet at the end of the day. But then a lot of people don't even know what to do with a beet at the end of the day. And we're up against these, like, food subscriptions where food comes to your door with a recipe and the spices, and sometimes it's pre-cut. And it's like, we've already grown all this food. Like, we can't possibly compete with someone who's doing that. Like, if the customers could meet us halfway, frankly, I feel like it would be nice. Like, we all have to make moves here to change the food system. And I feel like small farmers are doing so much already, and you know, it has to be a group consciousness thing. And if it's not, I don't know that we're going to be able to compete with all the other food options that are out there.
You kind of want to expect a farmer to say, what's the hardest part of your job? Well, you know, it's 13-hour days or 14-hour days. It's not really. It's not a physical thing. I think it's an emotional thing. Like Sarah says, it's hard to go to a farmer's market and have people not buy your produce, have walked right by you, even some say some nasty things about the stuff. That's emotionally hard because you have a lot of sweat and blood involved in your product. And it's also emotionally difficult to deal with issues like we had last year when you lose an entire carrot crop. It isn't the money. It wasn't the work you put into it. It's just, gosh, you know, how do you bounce back from that kind of loss? So it's an emotional thing, I think.
And, you know, we're talking about the difficult times, but there's also some great successes that you can have throughout farming. And, you know, Dave, you've been in the business for a while, and Sarah, you're pretty new, but do you guys remember your first farm memory where it's like, this is the first plant that I grew successfully, or, you know, what that crop was, or working the land, prepping it for something, and you look and you see and you realize and confirm to yourself, like, yes, this is what I need to be doing.
That happens every spring. It's like happens again and again and again and again. It's always new when I go out and I scan the field and I can see all the plants coming up and they're all healthy and the weeds have been under control. I get the same thrill I did the first time we did it when we had one CSA member and we were growing, selling things off the farm to now with 100 and whatever, 50 or 80 CSA members and selling off the farm. I get the same exact thrill as though it was the first time when I see the plants all in a row, the weeds kept under control, everything looking healthy. Yeah, it just keeps coming back.
My first real experience with that was actually this year. We're doing our first CSA. And when we got our first check in the mail, I almost was brought to tears just thinking, like, these people trust us enough to write us a check for almost $600, and they just trust that we're going to feed them. And it was just like so emotional for me just thinking that we have community out there that's willing to trust farmers even though there is a risk. And that's why I'm doing it.
When it comes to the future of farming, how do we get more people like Sarah to consider working a field versus working at a desk?
That's the $10,000 question, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. You know, I think, as we sort of mentioned before, partly you have to have the mindset. And sometimes it's not when you're 20 years old. Sometimes it's when you're, you know, in 30s or 40s. But so you have to have the mindset. And secondly, we have to show them that this is a profitable, interesting, challenging business to get into, that it's not just purely grunt work. You know, like I said before, I think farmers are some of the smartest people I know. They know how to fix things. They know how to plant things. They know how to sell things. They can manage money. They're an incredible group of people. So we need to continue to be successful. And then that success, I hope, breed success.
Yeah, and another thing I think that might get in the way of young people farming is just access to land and having land be so expensive, and so many of us are still paying off student loans. Yeah. And in our case, we live on a homestead, 14 acres, and not everyone who lives at the homestead is involved in the market farm, but we could never afford to live where we live if we didn't live with a group of people that was helping to pay for the property taxes and just all the costs that come in with living in that space.
That's the other thing that changed in the last 25 years. There was really no money available for us to start a farm back then. But now the USDA does offer new farmer grants and loans. And it sounds like I don't know the details of it, but show them a good business plan, show them that you have some experience, that you did some interning and things like that. And there's the potential for some grants and loans to start your business and expand your business. So that's a good thing. And I think more young people know about that might help. But land's a big issue.
Now, Dave, as we're sitting here with Sarah, I'm sure you're reminded of those first, you know, few seasons where you and Sandy were getting things started. Do you either of you have questions for each other, you know, while we're here?
I remember our first farmer's market, which was last June, and we're coming from a conventional field, and so we have a lot to make up for in fertility. And I just remember looking at our first market stand and being like, I wonder what Dave's market stand looked like for the first time. Like, I hope his vegetables looked worse than they look now, because there's hope for us that we'll
get
better. But yeah, it's just like, how have you seen difference in when you first started farming and first started working the land? And have you seen your soil grow? And have you seen the biodiversity change on your land?
Yeah, the first stuff was actually pretty good. We were on old pasture, not conventionally farmed land. So it had been in pasture for years and years and years. We had weed problem, grass problem, but the fertility was really good. It was the in-between years when we started to move on, where it took us a while to get the fertility up in the soil. And we're still working on that. As you know, we have very clay soils around here, and they take a good deal of organic matter and to keep them going. But I thought your stuff looked great. I thought
the stuff we brought.
But that's always the case. You know, that's always the case. You're always going to get 4 carrots that you're not going to bring to the market. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know.
That's what we eat.
That's what kimchi's all about, right?
Exactly. So, exactly.
Yeah, you're always going to get product like that. And you always want to bring your best product to the market. So don't let those other farmers there fool you, too, because they got a lot of 4 carrots and a lot of, you know, blemished radishes and whatnot.
Dave, anything for Sarah?
Yeah, I'm curious about the business plan and how you guys want to grow the business and how you plan on growing the business, because the way we did it seemed really backwards back in the bad old days when the hippies and hippie wannabes started this business and got into it. We just planted and sold. We didn't really think about what the future would be. You know, everything was in the present. That was a big mistake. I mean, I wish that I was more of Sam and Sarah when we were younger and we were starting this business, to have more of a business plan. We'd look different than we are now. We just sort of just kept growing things and selling things and growing things without any business plan.
We definitely have a business plan, but it's more so we have set financial goals for ourselves. And Sam is totally the mastermind behind all the planning, all the finances. I try to be involved in that as less as I can. But we have basically started with how much money do we hope to make so that we can pay for a year of life? And so we start there, and then we go, how much money do we need to make each week in order for that yearly salary to come to fruition? And then from there, we say, okay, how much do we need to sell of these things to make this much money? And that's where we plan our crops from. So it's kind of starting at a totally made up point and then working from there to figure out what our year is going to look like.
Yeah, but you're new. You have to start. You have to create a baseline.
Yeah. And so we went with something last year. We got to a certain point, and so we recalibrated for this year, and we thought about what was realistic based on our 1 year of business experience.
Did you overestimate last year or underestimate?
We didn't meet our goal, but we had a high goal.
Do you have any words of advice for Sarah going forth? And then, Sarah, do you have any advice or words of encouragement for people who are perhaps on the fence about getting into farming themselves?
I don't even have to tell her this because I'm sure that it's in her heart anyways, but don't lose the feeling, because that's what's important. I need to make money, but I would gladly give my vegetables away if I could.
Cool. Yeah, I like that mentality. And for people that haven't started yet and are thinking about it, the best thing that I can tell you is try growing some food and try seeing how it goes. Like, it's not going to be perfect your first time, but the most you can do is just start and try and talk to people. And if you're interested, there's so many people there that could use a hand on their farm if you want to get some experience or want to work. Just ask. Farmers are really nice people, and they'll usually always talk to you.
Farming contributor Dave Kozlowski owns and operates Pine Hole Gardens in Oak Creek with his wife, Sandy Rodens. Sarah Krohn owns and operates Village Farmstead in Oak Creek with her partner, Sam Oden. They spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you'll find previous farming conversations at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then we're joined in the performance studio by Milwaukee Mosaic ahead of a unique concert this week. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thursday evening at the Women's Club of Wisconsin, the consortium of musicians called Milwaukee Mosaic will present an evening of chamber music. What makes this concert different is that all of the pieces on the program are composed by women. From modern living composers Alyssa Firsova and Milwaukee's own Emily Cooley to 19th century composers like Henriette Renier.
The concert is dedicated to showcasing works that often don't get programmed. Three of the performers who will perform in the concert joined us in the Lake Effect Performance Studio: violinist Jeannie Kim, cellist Susan Babini, and harpist Kelsey Molinari. Welcome to all three of you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And we're going to hear some wonderful music in just a moment. But this is all in preparation for a concert that's happening on Thursday by Musaic. And it's all women composers, sort of in celebration of Women's History Month. And I think a lot of us, if we think about classical music outside of the concert hall, we're thinking of the composers we all know about. We know about Beethoven, we know about Brahms. We don't know a lot of women. Maybe some modern composers, but some of the things that are happening on this program happened in the 19th century. Right. The pieces we're hearing are by a French composer, and it sounds very French, and it sounds very impressionistic. So somebody jump in and tell me a little bit about who this woman was.
Well, this is Kelsey, and I am the harpist, so I feel like I should speak to Miss Henriette Renier. She is my great-grand teacher, and I think many, many harpists can say that she was one of the most influential harpists and harp teachers. The harp is a strange instrument because it did not evolve in its current form until about the mid-1800s. So most other modern instruments as we know them were pretty much figured out, but the harp had a little catching up to do.
And you're talking about the concert harp.
Yes, concert harp. And with all of its chromaticism and pedals, really didn't come into its own until Wagner started writing. But Henriette Renier is an absolute virtuoso. She was a child prodigy, and the piece Andante Religioso, I think, was written when she was in her early teens. Mm-hmm. She was a composer, a harpist, and influenced Ravel and Debussy, and is really a remarkable, remarkable woman who's inspired many other young men and women harpists.
Well, listening to the harp parts as we were in the other studio, mm-hmm. I mean, it's astounding. You're all over the instrument.
Yes, she definitely knew what was possible on this modern harp as we know it now and took it absolutely to the limit. She wrote a harp concerto. She wrote some other chamber music and a catalog of harp solos, which really put the harpists through their paces.
Well, Susan, what about the cello part in that Andante? Because that's gorgeous, too.
This is an absolutely beautiful cello part, and it's a lot of fun to play. And I was really struck by how much depth there is in that piece from somebody who is so young.
Is it as complex as the harp part? I mean, it sounds very, very rich.
It's complex in a different way, to try to spin a long line, but find enough color to keep it interesting. And pacing is really tricky with that one. So I'd say I'm not as busy as Kelsey is, for sure.
Thank you.
Jeannie, the piece that you play with her is a much faster tempoed piece. And the two of you are kind of talking constantly in this. There's this constant dialogue happening in that. And was that typical of her work that you know of?
She actually didn't write a whole lot of chamber music. I believe it's these two pieces and a trio for harp, violin, and cello are about her chamber music catalog. So we don't really have a lot to draw on.
That's too bad.
It is.
I mean, when you think about it, my God, these two pieces are beautiful. And to not have more.
I think at the time she was composing, it was not encouraged. So that may have something to do with why there's not a great deal of output for larger chamber ensembles or more concertos or more solo repertoire, because it just wasn't what a woman did.
Well, she wasn't supposed to be composing at all, right?
Right.
But she actually won a composition prize, the Grand Prix in Paris. So I think it was maybe 1880s or so.
Still very
but,
young.
Yeah, she was a very gifted composer. And I think when you play the piece, you don't realize how virtuosic it really is for the harp, because it's so artfully crafted. It comes out very organically. But if you look at the harpist, the harpist is really busy changing pedals. Do you have something like 6 pedal changes within
in one measure.
One measure. Okay, I thought it was 2 measures.
And how many pedals are there on the concert
There's
harp?
There's 7 total pedals, one for each note of the scale, so C through B, one for each. And they have 3 positions each, flat, natural, and sharp, and that's what happened in the mid-1800s is the harp was finally able to be that chromatic. The pedals were made double action instead of single. Before, it was just you were able to go from, say, naturals to flats, and now we have naturals, flats, and sharps.
And, of course, you've got both hands going as well.
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of like an organ except upright. I mean, you've got your feet. You have to coordinate all of your appendages.
Yes. Harpo Marx made it look easy.
Too bad you don't have like 8 legs.
8 legs, yeah. It's like if you were an octopus, it would be a lot easier.
So much easier.
Thank you. These two pieces are part of an overall concert that is celebrating women composers across basically the last 150 years or so. And, you know, I think it's really wonderful that we're starting to just kind of accept that women wrote good music, and we don't have to say it's women composers. We can just say composers.
It shouldn't be such a novelty anymore.
It shouldn't be. And unfortunately, it still seems to be. Although I think in what we consider modern classical music, there are more women who are just, it's just they're part of, you know, the repertoire, and we tend to just hear them more. But it's great that this concert is together, because I think a lot of people like me, I did not know of Renier before I heard you perform it here. And I thought, how have I missed her?
Well, it's incredible that the music does exist, but people need to start programming it. And, you know, so we're grateful to Jeannie and Sasha for doing that with their series. And we just need to get more people on board so that gorgeous music like, you know, what we just played today can be heard.
We're also featuring a piece by Emily Cooley, and she's a native of Milwaukee. She actually had a piece we played in the symphony last year or the year before. I think it was called
Green Go to Me.
Yeah, it was. And her style is very different than, I mean, obviously she's a living composer. The piece that we're playing for this concert is called Like Frost or Moss, and it's very atmospheric, features kind of like a just sparse number of elements, a rising minor third. And I would say there's a certain motif that happens in the piano that acts as kind of like markers of time. And she uses silence, actually, as well. So it's kind of like you have to really count out the measures of rest, because it is meaningful. You know, it's like all those students that they just play and then they just gloss over the rest of the lesson. You're like, no, the rest is actually part of the music, too. I mean, and in this case, really, it's part of the meaning. Because it's supposed to signal time passing, and very different style of music, but I think very effective as well, and kind of evocative. So yeah, we're happy to be featuring a native Milwaukee composer,
which is very cool. And I also notice on the list of musicians who are playing, you've only got a couple of guy ringers in there. It's all women, which is also fantastic. I mean, it shouldn't be such a big deal.
Right.
You know, I think Sasha was telling me as we were setting up earlier, it's like, you know, we've had 300 years of concerts made of all male composers and all male performers. Why is this a big deal? It shouldn't be. And I think it's fantastic that we have so many great musicians here that we can do that. Well, I know you have rehearsals to get to, because the two of you have to get to a symphony rehearsal, and you have to go and probably pack up the harp.
Yes.
Yeah.
Put
its jacket on and get it outside. But I want to thank you so much for coming in to perform and for chatting with us.
Thank you,
Bonnie. Thank you for having us.
Jeannie Kim is the Associate Concertmaster, Third Chair for the Milwaukee Symphony. Susan Babini is the symphony's principal cellist. And Kelsey Molinari is a harpist who's performed with symphonies around the world. They're all part of Milwaukee Mosaic, whose concert takes place Thursday evening at the Women's Club of Wisconsin in downtown Milwaukee.
The two pieces they played for us are also part of the concert. They were both by French composer Henriette Renier, Andante Religioso for cello and harp, and Scherzo Fantasy for violin and harp. Our in-studio performance was engineered by Jason Reavy. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air is next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.